Suppose that C has a Hufeldian claim against A, fine, where this claim implies a correlative moral duty on A's part not to phi. Further, suppose that A infringes on C's claim by fine in a way that imposes a cost upon C. Many rights theorists hold that A, in virtue of her fine, acquires a unique duty to, at least partially, compensate C for this cost, where this duty is unique in that no one else acquires a similar duty to compensate C for her loss. Call this proposition the compensation thesis. To illustrate the compensation thesis, consider the following case, adapted from a case originally produced by Joel Feinberg. Permissible infringement. Hiker is deep in the mountains when a surprise blizzard strikes. She knows that she will die without shelter, but fortunately stumbles across owner's unoccupied cabin. Hiker breaks a window to enter the cabin and thereby survives the storm. While the compensation thesis is both popular and intuitively plausible, as illustrated by the permissible infringement case, this paper will present two arguments for rejecting it. First, Section 1 argues that rights theorists face a trilemma when it comes to cases in which A blamelessly infringes on one of C's claims by fine. Section 2 considers and rejects the proposal that the trilemma can be resolved by positing that C does not, in fact, have a claim against A fine in such cases. Section 3 then presents an alternative way of resolving the trilemma that has recently been advanced by Renee Jorgensen. However, Section 7 argues that this proposal is implausible, as its supporting argument rests on a false dilemma. Thus, the paper concludes that the best way to resolve the trilemma is to reject the compensation thesis. The intervening sections, Sections 4, 5, and 6, present a second argument against the compensation thesis, namely that it is incompatible with a plausible interpretation of luck egalitarianism. Given this incompatibility, any rights theorist who endorses the thesis will be yoking their position to the negation of a plausible interpretation of a popular theory of distributive justice. Finally, Section 8 considers six quick arguments for the compensation thesis and finds them all lacking. Section 1, a trilemma for rights theorists. The first argument against the compensation thesis is that it gives rise to a trilemma that is best resolved by rejecting said thesis. This trilemma arises when one considers cases in which an agent blamelessly wrongs someone. Consider, for example, the following pair of cases, the former adapted from a case presented by Tom Doherty, and the latter adapted from a case presented by Jeff McMahon. Consent evidence. An unforeseeable glitch causes claim holder's computer to send aggressor an email from claim holder's account, reading, "Please phi, I want you to phi, and you have my permission to phi." Aggressor then phis on the basis of this message, causing claim holder to incur significant costs as a result. Forfeiture evidence. Claim holder has an identical twin who is a well-known mass murderer. Unbeknownst to claim holder, her twin is on a killing spree, and aggressor has seen the twin's picture on the news. By coincidence, claim holder's car breaks down in aggressor's neighborhood, and claim holder goes up to aggressor to ask for help. Before claim holder has a chance to say anything, aggressor knocks claim holder unconscious by fine. Claim holder incurs significant costs as a result. In both cases, aggressor seems to blamelessly wrong claim holder. She wrongs claim holder because claim holder has, by hypothesis, a claim against aggressor fine in both cases, and aggressor wrongs claim holder when she fails to discharge the correlative obligations. By contrast, the blameworthiness of an action depends at least in part on the agent's epistemic state, where this state might include her knowledge, her beliefs, the evidence she possesses, and/or the available evidence that she does not possess but has a duty to acquire, depending on one's particular theory of blameworthiness. For these purposes, the exact set of necessary and sufficient conditions of being blameworthy will be left unspecified, but it will be assumed that a person blamelessly phis if both her possessed evidence and the relevant evidence, i.e., the available evidence that she should have gathered, a notion that will also be left unspecified, suggests that a state of affairs obtains wherein it would be permissible for her to phi. When this placeholder account is applied to consent evidence and forfeiture evidence, one gets the result that aggressor is blameless in both cases. In the former case, the evidence that aggressor possesses suggests that claim holder has consented to aggressor fine, where such consent would negate claim holder's claim against aggressor fine. Granted, there was available evidence that aggressor could have gathered that would have suggested a different conclusion. For example, aggressor could have called claim holder to confirm that she has claim holder's permission to phi, where this would have resulted in claim holder clarifying that she does not, in fact, intend or want aggressor to fie. However, it does not seem like aggressor was epistemically negligent, informing her belief that claim holder consented based on the email alone. Thus, her relevant evidence is coextensive with her possessed evidence in this case. Given that this evidence suggests that claim holder has consented to aggressor fying, i.e., it is permissible for aggressor to fie, it follows that aggressor blamelessly fies in consent evidence. Similar remarks apply to the forfeiture evidence case. There, the evidence possessed by aggressor suggests that claim holder poses an imminent threat to her life, where posing an imminent threat is typically taken to negate claims against aggressive actions that would disarm that threat and are proportionate to the threat. Stipulating that aggressor fying would be proportionate to a threat on her life, it follows that aggressor's possessed evidence suggests that fying is permissible in her circumstances. And again, it does not seem like aggressor was negligent in failing to gather additional evidence prior to fying. Thus, her fying is blameless, as both her possessed evidence and the relevant evidence suggest that fying is permissible. Granted, the proposed account of blameless action is speculative, and different theorists might fill in the details in different ways. However, any adequate theory will seemingly yield the same result, namely, that aggressor acts blamelessly when she fies. Thus, in both consent evidence and forfeiture evidence, aggressor wrongs claim holder, but does so blamelessly. The trilemma for rights theorists arises when the compensation thesis is applied to these cases of blameless wronging. Recall from above that this thesis holds that if A wrongs C, then A alone must at least partially compensate C for the costs that C incurs in virtue of A's fine. Given that aggressor wrongs claim holder in both consent evidence and forfeiture evidence, the thesis implies that aggressor must make substantial transfers to claim holder such that aggressor internalizes the costs of fine rather than claim holder. However, this seems unfair. After all, in both cases, aggressor is morally fastidious and acting appropriately in light of her possessed evidence. Further, it does not seem that she has negligently failed to gather additional evidence relevant to assessing the permissibility of fine. Together, these facts support the judgment that it would be unfair if aggressor had to fully internalize the costs that fine imposes on claim holder. If one thinks that any acceptable theory of rights must fairly distribute the costs of rights infringement, then a contradiction is reached. It cannot simultaneously be the case that 1. Aggressor wrongs claim holder in consent evidence / forfeiture evidence, 2. The compensation thesis is true, and 3. The unfairness of aggressor internalizing the costs of fine in consent evidence / forfeiture evidence disqualifies any theory that implies that aggressor must do this. Thus, one of these independently plausible propositions must be rejected. Section 2. The non-infringement solution. One possible resolution of the trilemma is to reject Proposition 1, i.e., deny that aggressor wrongs claim holder in either consent evidence or forfeiture evidence. Call this the non-infringement solution. One way to formulate this denial is to hold that claim holder initially held a claim against aggressor fying, but lost that claim, either because she consented to aggressor fying or acted in a way that caused her to forfeit her claim. Given that claim holder no longer has a claim against aggressor fying, aggressor does not wrong claim holder and thus does not owe her any compensation. However, this proposal seems like an unacceptable way of resolving the trilemma. As a matter of pre-theoretical intuition, it seems clear that that claim holder does not consent to aggressor fying in consent evidence or in forfeiture evidence where nothing even resembling those consent occurs. Further, while there are many theories of what constitutes consent, none supports the judgment that claim holder consents in this case. On some views, claim holder consents to aggressor fying when claim holder forms some positive attitude toward aggressor fying, e.g., that she intends that aggressor fie. Alternatively, some hold that claim holder consents to aggressor fying when claim holder communicates some relevant bit of information to aggressor, e.g., that claim holder intends that aggressor fie. And others hold hybrid views that attach other necessary or sufficient conditions to the formation of the aforementioned attitudes and or communicative acts. For example, Jorgensen posits that either a relevant attitude or an act of communication is sufficient for consent. And Doherty holds roughly that claim holder consents if and only if she issues a relevant directive or permission to aggressor and various evidentiary conditions obtain that would justify aggressor's belief that claim holder issued the directive slash permission. Irrespective of which of these accounts one favors, one will not get the result that claim holder consents to aggressor fine and consent to evidence. While aggressor has evidence that claim holder intends that aggressor fie and issued a directive that she fie, claim holder does not, in fact, form any relevant pro attitude toward aggressor fieing and does not issue a directive or communicate any information at all to claim holder. Given that all of the listed accounts of consent take either attitude formation or an attempted communicative act to be a necessary condition of consent, it follows that claim holder does not consent to aggressor fieing. Granted, the foregoing list of accounts is just a quick survey, and there are many other accounts that have not been considered. However, it seems unlikely that any omitted account will hold that claim holder consents in consent to evidence for the simple reason that claim holder does not act at all. Indeed, it can be stipulated that her mental states do not even change, and seemingly any account of consent will hold that claim holder must act, or at the very least undergo some change in state if she is to consent to some action. Thus, it does not seem that claim holder could have consented to aggressor fine in consent evidence or forfeiture evidence. Similar remarks apply to theories of forfeiture. Irrespective of which theory one endorses, one will seemingly hold that claim holder must act or change in some way to forfeit a right. But given that, by hypothesis, she takes no action and undergoes no change in either consent evidence or forfeiture evidence, it does not seem that claim holder could forfeit her claim against aggressor fine. Given that claim holder neither consents to aggressor fine nor forfeits a claim against aggressor fine in either consent evidence or forfeiture evidence, the proponent of the non-infringement solution must maintain that claim holder either loses her claim involuntarily or never had a claim against aggressor fine in the first place. With respect to the latter proposal, one might argue that a complete specification of claim holder's claim and consent evidence would reveal that its content is actually qualified, such that claim holder has a claim against aggressor fine, except when aggressor receives an email from claim holder's account telling her that she may fie. Similarly, in forfeiture evidence, one might hold that claim holder is a claim against aggressor fine, except when aggressor is justified in believing that claim holder poses an imminent threat to her life. This specificationist approach is the alternative way of assessing the permissible infringement case discussed above. Recall that specificationists explain the all things considered permissibility of hiker's actions by holding that owner's claim against hiker using her cabin is really a claim against hiker using her cabin when hiker's life is not otherwise at risk. However, applying this specificationist approach to consent evidence and forfeiture evidence seems misguided. The appeal of specificationism is that it can explain why it's permissible for hiker to break into the cabin without making claims merely pro tanto considerations. But in consent evidence and forfeiture evidence, aggressor's fine is seemingly not permissible, all things considered. Thus, positing that claim holder's claim in each case contains an exception clause renders the proposed theory of rights extensionally inadequate. By denying that claim holder has a claim against aggressor fine, the specificationist version of the non-infringement solution avoids the implication that aggressor must bear the unfair burden of compensating claim holder. However, the absence of a claim against fine also unacceptably implies that aggressor acts permissibly when she fies. Similar remarks apply to the proposal that claim holder involuntarily loses her claim against aggressor fine in both consent evidence and forfeiture evidence. If claim holder does in fact lose her claim in this way, then there is no remaining basis for declaring aggressor's action to be impermissible, all things considered. Insofar as one wishes to preserve this all things considered deontic judgment, one must reject the involuntary claim loss version of the non-infringement solution as well. Section 3. The comparative fairness solution. The previous section has argued that there is no version of the non-infringement solution that can adequately resolve the trilemma of Section 1. This leaves two other propositions as candidates for rejection, the compensation thesis and the proposition that it would be unfair for aggressor to internalize the costs of fine and consent evidence and forfeiture evidence by compensating claim holder. This section will consider a defense of rejecting the latter proposition that has been raised by Jorgensen in her discussion of cases of blameless wronging. Call this proposal, i.e., the contention that it is not disqualifying for a theory to imply that aggressor must internalize the costs of fine, the comparative fairness solution. While Jorgensen concedes that there is something superficially troubling about a morally and epistemically fastidious aggressor having to uniquely internalize the costs of fine, She argues that this result should not be taken to be disqualifying, as one cannot simply assess the fairness slash acceptability of aggressor internalizing the costs of fine in isolation. Rather, the assessment must be comparative such that one considers the fairness slash acceptability of the alternatives to having aggressor internalize these costs. Thus, one must consider whether it would be fair slash acceptable for claim holder to internalize the costs of aggressor fine in cases of blameless wronging rather than aggressor internalizing them. And Jorgensen plausibly contends that this would be even more unfair than aggressor internalizing the costs. In defense of this point, one might note that even though aggressor was morally fastidious, the imposed costs are still attributable to her choice, while claimholder had no such direct causal connection to the generation of costs. Given this lack of connection, it seems more plausible that aggressor should internalize the costs, even if there is something theoretically unattractive about this outcome, given aggressor's blamelessness. Additionally, Jorgensen points out that it would be even more unfair for the victims of rights infringements to have to internalize the associated costs in cases where some members of society are more prone to having their rights blamelessly infringed than others. For example, suppose that there is a social practice that consistently generates misleading evidence about claim holders' intentions, such that multiple agents, aggressor and infringer, blamelessly infringe on claim holders' claims by fine. If each infringing agent has to internalize the costs that she respectively imposes, then the collective imposed costs in this case would be divided across aggressor and infringer. By contrast, if claim holder has to internalize the costs of infringement, then all of those costs would be concentrated on her, which seems like a much less fair outcome. In other words, irrespective of whether one endorses the compensation thesis, one must have a view about who should internalize the costs in cases of blameless infringement, like consent evidence and forfeiture evidence. Given the comparative implausibility of making claim holder internalize those costs, one should hold that aggressor must internalize these costs. Thus, one should resolve the trilemma presented in Section 1 by endorsing the comparative fairness solution. It is not disqualifying for a theory or thesis to imply that aggressor internalizes the costs of fine, as all theories must ultimately have implication to avoid the comparatively worse implication that claim holder must internalize the costs of aggressor fine. While this proposed solution to the trilemma is superficially plausible, it will subsequently be argued that it does not succeed. First, however, sections 4 through 6 will provide an independent argument for rejecting the compensation thesis, namely that the thesis is incompatible with a plausible interpretation of luck egalitarianism. This means that proponents of the thesis must incur the theoretical costs of committing themselves to the rejection of a plausible interpretation of a popular theory of distributive justice. Section 7 will then return to the comparative fairness solution, arguing that the previously introduced luck egalitarian approach reveals that Jorgensen's argument for this solution rests on a false dilemma. If one accepts a luck egalitarian theory of the kind described below, then one will have a principled basis for distributing the costs of aggressor's fine in an alternative way that is more plausible than either of the two options discussed just above. Thus, one cannot defend the implication that aggressor must internalize the costs of fine on the grounds that it is the most plausible of all the available options. Section 4. The compensation thesis as a rights-based allocative thesis. Before completing the foregoing argument against the compensation thesis, a second argument against the thesis must be introduced. This argument contends that the compensation thesis should be rejected because it is incompatible with a plausible interpretation of an influential theory of distributive justice, namely luck egalitarianism. However, to show that these two positions are incompatible, one must first show that they both pertain to the same subject matter. To this end, the present section and section 5 will demonstrate that both positions are rights-based allocative theories of justice in the sense that they both A, assign persons rights, where B, that assignment is a function of a prior judgment about the appropriate share of advantage that at least some persons should possess, where advantage is a placeholder term referring to whatever it is that matters morally when it comes to distributive justice. Having demonstrated this, Section 6 will then argue that the two positions are incompatible, as they imply contradicting rights assignments, with luck egalitarianism implying the existence of rights that are negated by the compensation thesis. Thus, endorsing the compensation thesis requires rejecting luck egalitarianism, and vice versa. That the compensation thesis implies an assignment of rights is readily apparent, as it asserts that person A owes duties of compensation to person C when A infringes on one of C's claims. Additionally, it is an allocative thesis in the following stipulative sense. The particular rights that it assigns to C and correlative duties that it assigns to A are a function of the shares of advantage that A should distribute to herself and C ceteris paribus. Note that the compensation thesis is a thesis about how imposed costs are to be distributed in cases of rights infringement, where any theory of cost distribution is ultimately a theory about how A is to distribute advantage. To say that A should incur a cost of X in virtue of fine is just to say that A should give herself a share of advantage equal to however much advantage she ends up with after fine minus X. Finally, note that the thesis's assignment of rights is a function of these prescribed shares, as it assigns rights in such a way that agents discharging their correlative duties would realize the prescribed distribution of advantage. For example, in consent evidence, the thesis assigns aggressor a remedial duty of compensation, such that the claim holder does not end up with an improper share of advantage. More specifically, it holds that aggressor, in virtue of her blameless fine, uniquely loses rights, specifically Hafeldian permissions, such that the claim holder ends up with the same share of advantage that she would have otherwise with aggressor, thereby fully internalizing the costs imposed by fine. Or alternatively, aggressor might uniquely lose claims against claim holder acting in ways that would make aggressor internalize those costs. For example, she might lose claims against claim holder seizing some of her holdings. In this way, the compensation thesis is revealed to be a thesis that assigns and negates rights, both permissions and claims, such that the discharging of all corresponding duties would realize a particular distribution of advantage among at least certain persons. One might object that in describing the compensation thesis as an allocative thesis, with all the associated talk of distributing appropriate shares of advantage, the foregoing argument conflates corrective justice and distributive justice. This distinction is one often drawn by torts theorists, who see torts as a matter of corrective justice and not distributive justice. Most minimally, those who endorse this distinction hold that principles of distributive justice assign shares of advantage, while principles of corrective justice apply only in circumstances where an agent has wrongfully interfered with another. In other words, corrective principles are distinct from distributive ones in that the former apply to only a subset of cases to which the latter apply. Given that the compensation thesis applies only in this proper subset of cases, one might conclude that it qualifies as a corrective principle rather than as a distributive principle. Some theorists elaborate on this minimal account by suggesting that principles of corrective justice differ from distributive principles and that they posit a more limited set of persons who either owe or are owed advantage-producing actions. For example, Jules Coleman argues that principles of corrective justice imply that only the wrongdoer has a duty to deliver resources to the wronged party. By contrast, distributive principles imply that other agents, e.g. the state, have duties to ensure that each person ends up with her appropriate share of advantage. Finally, some theorists contend that corrective principles are distinct from distributive principles because the former imply a distinct set of rival prescriptions about which transfers persons should make. On this account, principles of corrective justice imply that wrongdoers should make remedial transfers to their victims even when doing so upsets the distribution of advantage that is just according to the correct principles of distributive justice. For these purposes, one can grant that there is a distinction between distributive justice and corrective justice, as the incompatibility argument that will be made in Section 6 requires affirming only that the compensation thesis is an allocative principle in the very weak sense described above. It must simply assign at least some persons a duty to ensure that another person ends up with a particular share of advantage. So long as the compensation thesis assigns duties in this way, it will have overlapping subject matter with the interpretation of luck egalitarianism that will be presented in Section 5, thereby allowing for the subsequent demonstration that the two positions are incompatible. Granted, the compensation thesis may not qualify as a distributive principle, as the tort theorists above use the term. However, for the purposes of this argument, the thesis need not be distributive in the strong sense, and this is not what is asserted above. Rather, the contention advanced here is merely that the compensation thesis has at least some implications for when persons have duties to ensure that others attain a particular share of advantage, where this makes the thesis of a kind with luck egalitarianism, albeit a more general kind than what the tort theorists label distributive principles. Section 5. Luck egalitarianism as a rights-based allocative theory. To show that luck egalitarianism has the same subject matter as the compensation thesis, and that the two positions are in fact incompatible, the theory must be presented in some detail. Specifically, luck egalitarians hold that the distribution of advantage is just if and only if any inequality corresponds to some sanctionable choice on the part of the worse off. Different luck egalitarian theories then render this proposition fully determinant by specifying what advantage includes and which choices count as sanctionable. One can get a pre-theoretical, intuitive sense of which actions count as sanctionable by considering the following pair of cases alongside the standard luck egalitarian evaluation of said cases. Coyote bite. When she was a baby, Agent was bitten by a coyote while momentarily left unattended on the front stoop. As a result of the bite, she now suffers from untreatable pain. She otherwise lives a life identical in quality to that of her neighbor, Compensator. In this case, Agent is left worse off than Compensator by her injury. Additionally, there is no sanctionable choice on her part that would justify this inequality. She did not cause her own injury, and even if she did, she would not have been responsible for that injury, given that she was a baby. And, by hypothesis, she has not done anything else that might play the appropriate justificatory role. Thus, luck egalitarians would hold that the inequality between Agent and Compensator is unjust, with justice thereby requiring that Compensator make transfers to Agent, such that Agent is partially compensated for her suffering. Specifically, if there are n total people, including Agent and Compensator, they are otherwise equally situated, and the loss of advantage that Agent incurs is equal to x, then justice would require that each person make a transfer to Agent such that all persons incur a cost equal to x over n, thereby realizing an equal distribution of advantage. Thus, given the simplifying assumption that there are no other parties present in Coyote Bite besides those who are named, a simplifying assumption that will also be made for all of the other cases discussed in this paper, Compensator must make transfers up to the point where both she and Agent end up with x over 2 fewer units of advantage than they would have had absent the coyote attack. This assessment can be contrasted with the following case. Coyote wrestling. Despite knowing the dangers involved, Agent decides to wrestle a coyote for fun. In the process, she is bitten by the coyote, and the resulting injury leaves her with untreatable pain. She otherwise lives a life that is identical in quality to her neighbor, Compensator. In this case, too, Agent is left worse off than Compensator by her injury. However, unlike in Coyote Bite, luck egalitarians will say that Agent made a sanctionable choice when she decided to wrestle the coyote, where this choice renders the inequality between Agent and Compensator just. By declaring the inequality just, they are thereby able to avoid the implausible conclusion that justice requires Compensator making costly transfers to Agent. Given that it would seemingly be unfair if Agent and Compensator had to equally share the costs generated by Agent's choice, a theory of justice that prescribes such a distribution, e.g., one that demands strict equality, lacks extensional adequacy. By contrast, luck egalitarianism preserves its extensional adequacy by requiring that Agent internalize these costs. There are various accounts of sanctionable choice that yield the judgment that Agent chooses sanctionably in coyote wrestling, but not coyote bite. For example, the classical account holds that a person chooses sanctionably if and only if her choice leaves her worse off than others, and she is responsible for this outcome. However, in light of the various concerns that have been raised about this account, one might instead follow Jens Damgaard Thaysen and Andreas Albertsen, who contend that sanctionable choices are ones that generate costs that must be borne by someone. More precisely, these choices generate a smaller quantity of total advantage than some alternative choice available to the agent. In other words, they are choices that make it such that someone must end up with less advantage than they otherwise could have had. By declaring choices of this kind sanctionable, luck egalitarians ensure that it is the agent who ends up internalizing these imposed costs rather than anyone else. For example, in coyote wrestling, Agent chooses sanctionably because she makes it such that there is less total advantage to go around. Had she made a different choice, everyone could have lived rich, pain-free lives. However, by wrestling a coyote, she makes it so that someone must be left comparatively worse off. Either Agent's life goes worse due to the resultant pain, Or she's compensated for her suffering, but at compensator's expense. Given that someone must bear a cost as the result of her choice, that choice is sanctionable. Thus, on this interpretation of luck egalitarianism, any inequality generated by her internalizing the generated costs is just. So far, this discussion has all attempted to describe the particular shares of advantage that luck egalitarians think that a person should distribute to others, ceteris paribus. In other words, it has discussed the allocative aspect of luck egalitarianism. However, to show that the position is a rights-based allocative theory, it must show that luck egalitarianism assigns rights on the basis of its prescribed shares. To see why this is a plausible interpretation of the theory, note that the characterization of the theory above already suggests that the theory is appropriately stated in terms of rights. Specifically, note that the apparent questions that luck egalitarians seek to answer are A, whether compensator acquires a duty to eliminate inequality in coyote bite / coyote wrestling by either transferring advantage to agent or simply leveling down by reducing her own share of advantage, and B, whether agent has a duty to refrain from acting in ways that would involuntarily transfer advantage from compensator or level down by reducing compensator's share of advantage. After all, the point of the theory is seemingly to determine the permissibility of redistribution, where this permissibility will be a function of person's various permissions and duties to redistribute. Thus, luck egalitarianism must be construed as a theory of duties. Of course, duties do not necessarily entail the existence of some correlative right, as they might be non-directed, i.e., not owed to any particular persons. However, it seems plausible to think that luck egalitarianism's posited duties are directed, given the fact that it seems that compensator would wrong agent in coyote bite if she were to refuse to transfer any advantage to agent. To fail to discharge this duty would be to deny agent her just share and also benefit at agent's expense. Such a choice would seemingly give agent a basis for complaint against compensator and render feelings of resentment on her part apt, where both of these facts are signature features of agent having a right infringed. And for identical reasons, it seems that agent would wrong compensator in coyote wrestling if she were to try to restore equality by either taking some of compensator's holdings or otherwise diminishing compensator's advantage. While luck egalitarianism is not typically articulated using the language of rights, I have recently defended a luck egalitarian theory that rejects the existence of property claims and instead assigns persons natural luck egalitarian rights over resources. On my view, quote, each person is assigned a set of claims such that the luck egalitarian principle would be satisfied if all persons respected the claims of others. That is, any inequality would appropriately correspond to some sanctionable choice on the part of the worse-off individuals. Or, to put this point slightly differently, each person would have a claim against anyone else using an unowned resource in some way, if and only if that use would leave her with less than her appropriate share of advantage, where her appropriate share is either A, equal to the respective shares of those who have not yet chosen sanctionably, if she has also not yet chosen sanctionably, or B, adjusted downward from this value if she has chosen sanctionably. End quote. Notably, condition B implies that sanctionable choice leads to rights forfeiture. For example, prior to wrestling the coyote, agent has a set of claims against others using resources in ways that will leave her worse off than them. However, after her choice, she loses some subset of these claims. Specifically, if one endorses the general approach to sanctionable choice posited above, she loses a subset of claims such that justice requires her fully internalizing the cost that she produces, such that compensator does not have to internalize those costs. When luck egalitarianism is presented in these terms, namely as a theory of egalitarian rights that are forfeited when agents choose sanctionably by generating costs, then it becomes apparent that it is a theory of the same kind as the compensation thesis. Specifically, both theories assign rights and duties such that everyone discharging their respective duties will realize a desired distribution of advantage across at least certain persons. The question then becomes whether these two theories are compatible. The subsequent section will answer this question in the negative. The two theories imply incompatible judgments when applied to cases of blameless wronging, like consent evidence and forfeiture evidence. Section 6. The incompatibility of luck egalitarianism and the compensation thesis. According to the interpretation of luck egalitarianism provided just above, An agent loses claims against others using resources in advantage-diminishing ways when the agent makes a choice that generates costs. However, the proposal is arguably imprecise, as a natural amendment to this statement is that the agent loses these claims only if the evidence she possesses, and the evidence that she reasonably ought to have gathered, suggests that her action will generate such costs. To motivate this thought, consider the following case. Coyote surprise. Agent decides to go for a run in an urban area known for its safety. However, in an unprecedented event, a coyote that had just escaped from the nearby zoo leaps out of a bush and bites Agent, and the resulting injury leaves her with untreatable pain. She otherwise lives a life that is identical in quality to that of her neighbor, Compensator. Intuitively, it seems that Agent's normative status in Coyote Surprise is of a kind with Agent's status in Coyote Bite, rather than with Agent's status in Coyote Wrestling. Specifically, in both Coyote Bite and Coyote Surprise, it seems unfair if Agent is left worse off than Compensator. By contrast, it does not seem unfair if Agent is left worse off than Compensator in Coyote Wrestling. And in fact, it would seemingly be unfair if Compensator had to compensate Agent for her suffering. If this intuitive judgment is determinative, then one must adjust the proposed account of sanctionable choice to accommodate it. As currently stated, the account implies that Agent chooses sanctionably in Coyote Surprise, as she acts in a way that generates costs. Had she not chosen to go for a run, the coyote, by hypothesis, would not have bitten anyone, with no distributable costs thereby being generated. To avoid this implication, the account must be amended such that Agent's choice in Coyote Surprise does not count as sanctionable. An extensionally adequate account will thus deliver this judgment while still preserving the implications that A, Agent chooses sanctionably in Coyote Wrestling, and B, Agent does not choose sanctionably in Coyote Bite. To deliver these results, one can adjust the account by making sanctionable choice a function of blameworthy cost imposition, with evidence-based foreseeability being a necessary condition of blameworthiness. On this approach, the explanation for why it's fair to hold Agent accountable for the imposed costs in Coyote Wrestling is that Agent is to blame for those costs, as she both causes them and the possessed and relevant evidence suggest that her choice will bring them about. Similarly, it would be unfair to hold Agent accountable in Coyote Bite because she is not to blame for those costs, since she did not cause them. And, while Agent does cause the costs in Coyote Surprise, that imposition of costs is not blameworthy, due to the fact that given both her evidence and the evidence more broadly available to her, she could not foresee that her action would impose those costs. If this is correct, then the rights-based approach to luck egalitarianism can be understood as asserting the following. In any case where some person carries out some cost-imposing action phi, her rights to advantage, i.e. her permissions to act in ways that would yield some specified share of advantage, and her claims against actions that would reduce this share of advantage, are uniquely lost only if either her possessed evidence or the relevant evidence suggests that fine will generate costs that must ultimately be distributed across persons. Thus, Agent would not uniquely lose any rights to advantage in Coyote Surprise, but would uniquely lose such rights in Coyote Wrestling. Contrast this result with that implied by the compensation thesis. The latter holds that when aggressor fies in cases like consent evidence and forfeiture evidence, she uniquely loses those rights to advantage that would cause her to fully internalize the cost that she generates. Further, aggressor loses these rights even though neither her evidence nor the relevant evidence suggests that fine will impose these costs. However, note that this conclusion directly contradicts the luck egalitarian thesis presented in the previous paragraph, namely, that blameworthiness is a necessary condition of a person uniquely losing rights to advantage. Thus, accepting the compensation thesis requires rejecting rights-based luck egalitarianism. This is a high theoretical cost for a rights theorist to incur, as it yokes the adequacy of the thesis to the falsity of a plausible interpretation of a popular theory of distributive justice. While this might not trouble libertarians and others who explicitly reject luck egalitarianism, rights theorists without such commitments might be reluctant to take on such a significant commitment vis-a-vis distributive justice. More directly, to affirm the compensation thesis is to deny that blameworthiness insulates agents from uniquely losing rights to advantage. Thus, proponents of the solution cannot appeal to Agent's blamelessness in Coyote Surprise to support the exculpatory judgment that Agent does not have to fully internalize the cost she incurs as a result of going for a run. Absent this theoretical resource, they may find themselves committed to the proposition that justice requires Agent fully internalizing the costs of being attacked by a coyote in Coyote Surprise, a result that many might find troubling, even setting aside the more general question of whether the compensation thesis is incompatible with rights-based luck egalitarianism. Section 7, against the comparative fairness solution. Having introduced luck egalitarianism, it is now possible to explain why the comparative fairness solution does not adequately resolve the trilemma of Section 1. Recall that this solution holds that it is in fact fair for agents to internalize the costs of blameless fying. Granted, this position is prima facie implausible, as even Jorgensen concedes that it seems unfair to make agents like aggressor bear the costs in cases of blameless rights infringement. However, as noted above, Jorgensen suggests that it is ultimately fair to make aggressor internalize the costs of blameless fying because this is the least unfair option available, since the alternative of making claim holder internalize those costs is even less fair. This section argues that this inference rests on a false premise. If one accepts the luck egalitarian position, then one can, and indeed must, endorse a third alternative prescription vis-a-vis consent evidence and forfeiture evidence. Further, this alternative appears to be a fairer option than either of the ones that Jorgensen considers. Thus, one cannot defend the comparative fairness solution by appealing to the comparative unacceptability of the available alternatives. To see what luck egalitarianism implies vis-a-vis consent evidence and forfeiture evidence, recall first what it prescribes in cases like Coyote Bite and Coyote Surprise, wherein an agent imposes costs but is not blameworthy for doing so. As noted in Section 5, if all parties start out equally situated, then any imposed costs must be distributed equally across persons. Thus, in both cases, if the pain of the coyote bite reduces agent's advantage by X units, then compensator must make transfers to agent such that they each incur a cost of X over 2, since they are the only two parties present in the scenario. This distribution of costs ensures that the overall distribution of advantage remains equal, thereby avoiding the injustice of an inequality that cannot be vindicated by some sanctionable choice on the part of the worse off. Given that consent evidence and forfeiture evidence are of a kind with coyote bite and coyote surprise, i.e., they are cases in which an imposed cost that does not correspond to some sanctionable choice must be distributed, luck egalitarians would prescribe the same distribution of costs. Aggressor and claim holder should each internalize half of the total costs of aggressor fying. Thus, luck egalitarianism reveals, via its prescription, that there is an alternative way of distributing the costs of blameless fying beyond having either aggressor or claim holder fully internalize them. Further, note that this proposed distribution seems fairer than either of the proposed alternatives. Given that no one is to blame for the imposed costs, it would be arbitrary, and thus unfair, to make only aggressor or only claim holder incur those costs. By contrast, an equal division of costs across persons seemingly avoids this arbitrariness slash unfairness. Finally, note that this proposal also resolves Jorgensen's worry that it would be comparatively less fair for claim holder to internalize the costs of aggressor fine in cases where claim holder, for social reasons, is prone to having her rights infringed. Recall the case from Section 3, wherein claim holder ends up having her claims infringed by both aggressor blamelessly fine and later infringer blamelessly fine. The plausible suggestion above was that it would be fairer for aggressor and infringer to internalize their respective imposed costs than have claim holder internalize both sets of costs. However, again, to consider only these two options is to propose a false dilemma, as the luck egalitarian would endorse a third option that seems fairer than either of the aforementioned ones. For each instance of blameless rights infringement, each party should internalize an equal share of the costs. In other words, aggressor, infringer, and claim holder would each absorb one-third of the costs of aggressor fine and one-third of the cost of infringer fine. This outcome precludes claim holder from having to bear any special burden resulting from others' propensity to infringe her rights. Given that aggressor internalizing the costs of blameless fine is not the least unfair option available, Jorgensen cannot infer that it is fair tout court. Thus, Jorgensen's argument for the comparative fairness solution must be rejected. Further, one should reject the solution itself, as it is prima facie implausible, and is no longer backed by a supporting argument capable of overriding that prima facie judgment. This rejection, when paired with Section 2's rejection of the non-infringement solution, leaves only one remaining option for resolving the trilemma of Section 1. Reject the compensation thesis. Section 8. Arguments for the compensation thesis. The previous sections have presented two distinct arguments against the compensation thesis. First, there was the incompatibilist argument of sections 4 through 6, which tried to show that those who endorsed the thesis must pay the high theoretical price of rejecting rights-based luck egalitarianism. Second, there was the argument by elimination. To resolve the trilemma of section 1, one must choose between endorsing the non-infringement solution, endorsing the comparative fairness solution, or rejecting the compensation thesis, where only the last-mentioned option is theoretically acceptable. However, these arguments must be weighed against the positive arguments that can be marshaled in support of the compensation thesis. This section considers 6 such arguments and argues that none of them succeed. To begin, one might argue for the compensation thesis and simultaneously object to the incompatibility argument of Section 6 by suggesting that actually luck egalitarianism implies the judgment that aggressor must uniquely compensate claim holder in cases like consent evidence and forfeiture evidence, which is to say that luck egalitarianism implies the compensation thesis. This argument takes the signature commitment of luck egalitarianism to be holding people responsible for their choices by making them internalize the resulting costs. For example, when agents gamble and lose, luck egalitarians classically hold that any resulting inequality is just, with the losers thereby not being entitled to any compensation for their bad option luck. Further, to compensate them would be unjust, as that would make others absorb the costs of their reckless choices. However, when applied to consent evidence and forfeiture evidence, luck egalitarianism would then imply that aggressor should absorb the costs of her choice to fie, as this outcome would be just, because it is simply making aggressor internalize the costs resulting from the gamble she made by fieing, with the alternative being unjust, as claim holder would then be forced to absorb the costs created by aggressor. Further, the way to make it such that aggressor internalizes the costs of her wrongdoing is by having her pay compensation to claim holder. Thus, contrary to the foregoing argument, luck egalitarianism actually supports the compensation thesis's contention that wrongdoers have a unique duty to compensate the wronged parties for any harm inflicted. The reply to this argument begins with the observation that there are many rival interpretations of luck egalitarianism, each with its own distinct set of implications. Some of these interpretations offer rival accounts of what qualifies as advantage, i.e., what it is that must be distributed equally in the absence of sanctionable choice. Others differ with respect to whether they declare an equality unjust when one party has chosen sanctionably, as discussed in Note 28 above. For these purposes, the relevant point of interpretive disagreement is over which choices qualify as sanctionable. Specifically, note that the just presented luck egalitarian argument for the compensation thesis presupposes the following interpretation of sanctionable choice. An agent chooses sanctionably if she makes it such that an otherwise avoidable cost must now be absorbed by some person or persons. Thus, when aggressor generates a distributable cost in consent evidence or forfeiture evidence, she is held to have made a sanctionable choice, making the just outcome one where she is left worse off than claim holder. This proposed account of sanctionable choice is seemingly identical to the one proposed in Section 5. There, following Thaysen and Albertson, it was suggested that a sanctionable choice is one that generates costs that must be borne by someone, with this account supporting the just presented argument's conclusion that aggressor chooses sanctionably in consent evidence / forfeiture evidence. However, recall that Section 6 argued that an interpretation of luck egalitarianism that incorporates this account of sanctionable choice is extensionally inadequate, as it generates unacceptable results in Coyote Surprise. In that case, it was posited that agent does not choose sanctionably, i.e., it would be unjust if she were left worse off than others, despite the fact that she made a choice that generated costs. Given that the posited interpretation of luck egalitarianism / sanctionable choice yields an unacceptable result in Coyote Surprise, it was argued that one must reinterpret the notion of sanctionable choice such that sanctionable choices include only those where the agent is blameworthy for producing some costs, where blameworthiness is a function of what is foreseeable given the available evidence. Finally, since aggressor is not blameworthy in either consent evidence or forfeiture evidence, this extensional adequacy-improving reinterpretation of luck egalitarianism implies that she does not choose sanctionably, and thus that it would be unjust if she had to fully internalize the cost of fine. In short, while some interpretations of luck egalitarianism do imply the compensation thesis, and thus function as arguments for the thesis, these interpretations are unacceptable due to being extensionally inadequate. The first proposed argument for the compensation thesis is therefore unsound, and also fails as an objection to the incompatibility argument of Section 6. Second, one might endorse the compensation thesis on the more general grounds that it would be unfair if the rights holder had to incur costs generated by someone violating her rights. However, the discussion of the previous section serves to undermine this proposal. While it might initially seem unfair to impose costs on claim holder in cases like consent evidence and forfeiture evidence, this judgment is substantially softened once one considers that the only alternative is making blameless aggressor fully internalize the costs, an alternative that runs contrary to both luck egalitarianism and the broad set of intuitive judgments to which its proponents appeal. As discussed in Section 7, once one notes that it seems equally unfair for either a blameless aggressor or a wronged claim holder to fully internalize the costs of aggressor's blameless action, then having claim holder internalize half of the imposed costs does not seem unfair. Third, one might appeal to Lauren Lomasky's argument for the compensation thesis. Unfortunately, this argument rests partially on Lomasky's theory about the grounds of rights, and fully recapitulating and critically engaging with this theory would go beyond the scope of this paper. However, a more general version of the argument can be posited that does not presuppose Lomasky's grounding theory. On this reconstruction, when assessing who should internalize the costs of fine, one must look to whose projects are advanced by the fine, where a project is roughly an end that a person is committed to realizing via some long-term, self-conception-modifying, life-structuring plan. For example, in the permissible infringement case, Lomasky notes that it is only hiker whose ends are advanced by the use of owner's cabin. Again, setting aside the exact details of Lomasky's account, he suggests that it would be inappropriate for owner to then incur the costs associated with hiker using the cabin to survive for the sake of pursuing hiker's various projects. Indeed, one might generalize this judgment by positing that it is unfair to make a victim of rights infringement internalize the costs of said infringement when the benefits of that infringement are internalized by the perpetrator of the infringement. Given that such a distribution of costs would seemingly be unfair even if the cost-imposing action were not a rights infringement, this Lomasky-inspired principle seems plausible. Despite its plausibility, this principle fails to support the compensation thesis for two related reasons. First, there will be many cases of infringement where the beneficiary of the action is someone other than the infringing agent. For example, suppose that in consent evidence, aggressor fies with the intention of benefiting both claim holder and a third party, beneficiary, the latter of whom actually benefits, unlike claim holder, who incurs a cost, as per the initial description of the case. Given that aggressor does not intend to benefit from fine and does not internalize any benefits, the Lomasky-inspired principle would not support the judgment that aggressor should internalize the costs of fine. Rather, seemingly either beneficiary or both claim holder and beneficiary should internalize the costs, given that they are the intended beneficiaries of the action. The second problem with the argument from Lomasky's principle is that it fails to take into consideration how luck egalitarianism bears upon the question of whose projects are advanced by a given act of fine. Note that if luck egalitarianism is correct, the benefits of any given action are effectively socialized, as justice requires that any generated advantage be distributed in a way that realizes an equal distribution, or, more precisely, a distribution that is either equal or unequal in a way that corresponds to previous sanctionable choices. For example, suppose that augmenter blamelessly wrongs cost-bearer by fine, where fine produces Y units of total distributable advantage, but also imposes a cost of X on cost-bearer. Further, suppose that A, Y is greater than X, B, augmenter and cost-bearer are the only existing people, an assumption of all the cases in this paper, C, they possess equal quantities of advantage, and D, neither has previously made a sanctionable choice. How, then, should X and Y be distributed? If the compensation thesis were false, the luck egalitarian would say that cost-bearer's loss of X should first be offset using the gain of Y to restore equality, with the remainder of the gains from Y being divided equally between augmenter and cost-bearer, i.e., both augmenter and cost-bearer receive Y minus X over 2 units of advantage. This distribution of the costs and benefits of fine would result in augmenter and cost-bearer ending up with equal quantities of advantage, which is what justice requires. Suppose now that the compensation thesis is correct in addition to luck egalitarianism. Seemingly, one would first prescribe that advantage should be equalized in the way just described, as this is what luck egalitarianism requires. One must then factor in the compensation thesis, where its contribution must seemingly be that augmenter must pay additional compensation to costbearer even after the costs incurred by costbearer have been offset by egalitarian redistribution. For example, if the thesis is taken to hold that augmenter must pay full compensation to costbearer, then one might hold that augmenter must now make additional transfers to costbearer such that costbearer gains an additional X units of advantage. There are two things to note about this proposal. First, this case functions as an additional reply to the fairness argument for the compensation thesis. Given that luck egalitarianism already ensures that costbearer is fully compensated for her incurred costs, at least in cases where augmenter's actions generate a positive quantity of distributable total advantage on net, then fairness does not seem to require her receiving any additional compensation from augmenter. Second, the luck egalitarian prescription makes it unclear that augmenter is the beneficiary of her fine, thereby undermining the Lomasky-inspired rationale for endorsing the compensation thesis. Given that augmenter must redistribute her gains in an equality-realizing way, it no longer seems that augmenter's fine is advancing her project. Rather, it is advancing a collective egalitarian project, only the particular shape of which is influenced by augmenter's choice. Granted, augmenter might be the de facto beneficiary of her fine if she declines to carry out the mandated luck egalitarian transfers to costbearer. And in such a case, she would be obliged to make transfers to costbearer. However, this obligation would be an implication of luck egalitarianism, rather than one grounded in the appropriate distribution of the benefits of a rights infringement. Thus, the Lomasky-inspired argument does not seem to support the compensation thesis. A fourth argument for the compensation thesis is that it is needed to adequately recognize claim holder's status of having a claim against aggressor fine in consent evidence and forfeiture evidence. Note that a luck egalitarian theory of rights that excludes the compensation thesis yields identical distributive prescriptions in consent evidence, forfeiture evidence, and coyote surprise. In all three cases, the imposed costs of blameless choice, i.e. aggressors and agents' choices, are distributed equally across all parties. Thus, the fact that claim holder has a claim violated in consent evidence / forfeiture evidence, while compensator does not suffer such a violation in coyote surprise, seems to make no normative difference as far as the proposed compensation thesis rejecting theory is concerned. However, it seems as though claim holder's claim should make some normative difference. This argument can be sidestepped by maintaining that even though aggressor does not have to compensate claim holder when aggressor blamelessly wrongs her, aggressor still has a duty to apologize to claim holder for violating her claim. Such a remedial duty can then serve to distinguish the normative status of compensator in coyote surprise from claim holder in consent evidence / forfeiture evidence. While both agents impose costs, only aggressor must apologize for her action, where this fact reflects aggressor's unique species of wrongdoing. Thus, no duty of compensation is needed to distinguish agents who impose costs by wronging others, e.g. aggressor in consent evidence, from those who simply impose costs, e.g. agent in coyote surprise. Fifth, one might be attracted to the compensation thesis because it serves other important normative functions. Consider, for example, an argument that Jorgensen makes in the context of defending the fairness of person acculturated internalizing the full costs of fine when A, she blamelessly wrongs person communicator because B, acculturated relies on a social convention that is morally problematic in some way. E.g., communicator says, "You may not fi, but there is a conventional understanding in her society that this really means you may fi when uttered by women." Jorgensen argues that holding people responsible for acting on the evidence furnished by bad conventions, i.e., making them internalize the costs of their resulting wrongful actions, helps maintain and improve their responsiveness to moral reasons. Jorgensen argues that when acculturated relies on a bad convention, she fails to respond to the various moral reasons for not acting on that convention. This mistake is then corrected by holding acculturated responsible, as, by making acculturated internalize the costs of her fine, acculturated and others are put, quote, in a position to recognize that the conventional signals are bad ones, quote. Assuming that an adequate moral theory will be one that countenances this educative process, it follows that one should allow for acculturated being held responsible for the costs of fine. Jorgensen's discussion focuses on cases where A, acculturated's available evidence suggests that fine is permissible, and B, the fact that the evidence suggests this is morally problematic. However, her reasoning might equally apply to cases like consent evidence and forfeiture evidence, where the evidence is not morally problematic. In cases of morally problematic conventions, the badness of those conventions gives agents reason to refrain from acting on the evidence furnished by those conventions. Holding them responsible for any resultant wrongs is then a way of drawing their attention to those overlooked reasons. Note, though, that the same reasoning might apply in consent evidence and forfeiture evidence. Aggressor has reason to refrain from acting on the evidence provided to her because it is not reliable. Thus, Jorgensen might maintain that aggressor should be held responsible for fine as a way of attuning her to this overlooked reason, where the compensation thesis must be affirmed if aggressor is to be held responsible in this way. The first thing to note about the foregoing argument is that it has an empirical element that might be questioned. Does discharging compensatory duties really educate wrongdoers in the posited way? Without collecting actual relevant data, it is hard to affirm this with certainty. Further, insofar as pre-empirical hypothesizing goes, it seems equally plausible that discharging a duty to apologize would educate at least as effectively as discharging a compensatory duty. Note that Jorgensen's hypothesis is that discharging compensatory duties will draw the agent's attention to the relevant reasons on which she should have acted. However, aggressor apologizing to claimholder would seemingly equally emphasize to aggressor that she should not have fied in cases like consent evidence and forfeiture evidence. In fact, the semantic nature of apology makes a duty of apology seem better suited for educating aggressor than a duty of compensation. In theory, aggressor could discharge a duty to compensate claimholder without any understanding of what she did wrong or why she must carry out the act of compensation. By contrast, an adequate apology would require such an understanding. Thus, the educative effect of complying with a theory of rights that posits a duty of apology seems likely to be even greater than the effect of complying with the compensation thesis, though, ultimately, empirical observation and experimentation would be needed to conclusively demonstrate this point. Finally, it is worth considering an argument for the compensation thesis developed in the literature on tort theory and advanced in various forms by Ernest Weinrib, Arthur Ripstein, and John Gardner. In particular, the discussion will focus on Gardner's version of this argument, as he develops the point in greater detail and in explicitly moral terms. Consider the case where A owes C a duty not to fie. As Gardner presents the argument, there is some more fundamental moral reason that R grounds, and thus explains, A's duty. Now, suppose that A breaches her duty by fieing. Gardner argues that in such a case, A no longer has a duty not to fie, as presumably, agents cannot have duties to do what cannot be done. However, while the duty is negated, Gardner argues that R persists. First, it persists in the sense that A still has reason to fie were she able to do so, e.g. if she had the power to change the past. More importantly, it persists in the sense that the same reason for refraining from fieing can also be a reason to undertake other actions now that A has fied. Specifically, it will often be a reason to compensate C via some compensatory action psi, as compensating at least partially conforms to R now that full conformance is impossible. For example, Gardner suggests that everyone who rides a bus might have a duty to pay the fare up front because they all share the following reason to pay. Paying, quote, helps to see to it that the bus company gets paid for the services it provides and hence is encouraged to provide them, end quote. If someone then forgets to pay the fare, she no longer has a duty to pay the fare before riding, but the posited grounds of this duty now become a reason for her to retroactively mail a check to the company, with this reason grounding an associated compensatory duty. Gardner calls this account of remedial duties the continuity thesis, and it seems to function as an argument for the compensation thesis. A acquires a duty to compensate C in virtue of her fieing because the ground of her duty not to fie becomes a duty-generating reason to compensate C. While this is an elegant explanation of A's remedial duty, it is vulnerable to two objections. First, the extent to which the continuity argument supports the compensation thesis depends on the specific reasons that ground all existing and future duties. In the bus case, it is apparent how post-infringement compensation advances the same end as discharging the initial duty. However, It is far from clear that the ground of every duty will also be a reason for the duty holder to provide compensation after she breaches that duty. If it turns out that there are even some duty grounding reasons such that one cannot conform to those reasons by providing compensation, then the continuity argument will not support the compensation thesis in its very general form. Second, even if one sets aside this first objection, the continuity argument does not support the compensation thesis's contention that A uniquely has a duty to compensate C in virtue of her fine. To see this, consider an abstract version of Gardner's bus case, wherein everyone has a duty not to fie grounded in some shared reason R. Further, suppose that A breaches her duty slash fails to conform to R by fieing, where the next best mode of conformance is compensating C by sighing. Thus, according to the continuity thesis, R now grounds A having a compensatory duty to sigh. But why does third party B not also have a duty to sigh? After all, B had the same duty not to fie as A, where that duty was grounded in R. And now, just like A, she cannot conform to R by making it such that C is not subjected to fieing. Finally, given that A's optimal conformance with R requires sighing under such circumstances, it seems that conformance with R would equally require that B sigh under these circumstances, where this requirement gives rise to a remedial duty to sigh. In short, A and B seem to be symmetrically situated vis-a-vis R, phi, and psi. Thus, if the continuity thesis implies that A acquires a remedial duty to psi, it seemingly also must imply that B acquires a duty to psi. Or, put another way, Gardner seems committed to affirming that when it comes to conforming to R, the best thing to do is ensure that C does not suffer from phiing, and failing that, ensuring that C is the beneficiary of an act of psiing. Given that, by hypothesis, R applies equally to both A and B, B must sigh to conform with her reasons. Thus, the continuity thesis seemingly implies that B also has a remedial duty to sigh. Such a result fails to support the compensation thesis's contention that A, and A alone, has a duty to sigh given her fine. This point can be made less abstract by applying it to Gardner's bus case. There, it was posited that each person has a duty to pay her fare because A, she has reason to ensure that the bus company continues to operate, and B, paying the fare conforms to that reason, presumably because, absent payment, the company will scale back its operations. When A breaches her duty by failing to pay her fare, she threatens the operations of the bus company. Thus, Gardner concludes that she must pay compensation to conform to her reason, as such compensation will have a similar effect with respect to sustaining the company's operations. However, note that some other bus rider, B, equally has the same reason to pay her fare, namely she aims to preserve the company's operations. And now that A has threatened these operations via non-payment, it seems that B, too, has reason to mail a compensatory check to the company to keep the buses running, with her payment being just as good as A's payment vis-a-vis sustaining the company's operations. Granted, such action might not be needed if she knew that A were mailing the check instead. And she would be better off if A were the one to compensate the company. However, the same things can be said of A with respect to B. Thus, as far as having reason to compensate goes, the two seem to be symmetrically situated, with the continuity argument failing to demonstrate that A, rather than B, has a duty to provide compensation. Against this objection, the proponent of the continuity argument might reply that A and B are not, in fact, symmetrically situated in either this case or its more generalized version above. This is because A, unlike B, has previously failed to conform to R by fieing, where any adequate interpretation of the continuity thesis holds that this gives A special reason to compensate C, such that only A ends up with a compensatory duty. The problem with this reply is that it begs the question. Note that the proposition that A has a special duty grounding reason to compensate C in virtue of breaching her duty not to fie is just a reassertion of the compensation thesis. Thus, if the continuity thesis is interpreted in these terms, or the continuity argument relies upon this proposition in any way to establish the asymmetry of A and B vis-a-vis C, R, and sighing, then it is assuming what it aims to prove, namely that prior duty infringement grounds a unique duty to compensate. There may well be further arguments for the compensation thesis beyond the six listed above. Given this possibility, this section cannot be treated as a conclusive demonstration that no argument for the thesis succeeds. That said, there is, prima facie, limited reason for endorsing the compensation thesis. It should thus be rejected to both resolve the trilemma of Section 1 and avoid any contradiction with rights-based luck egalitarianism. Section 9. Conclusion. This paper has presented two arguments against the compensation thesis. First, it has argued that the thesis is incompatible with a plausible interpretation of luck egalitarianism, as the latter posits that blameworthiness is a necessary condition of forfeiting rights to advantage, while the former implies that rights to advantage are forfeited in cases where that condition is not met. Second, the paper has presented a trilemma for rights theorists. In cases of blameless wronging, one cannot simultaneously hold that 1. Someone is wronged, 2. The compensation thesis is true, and 3. It is unfair for a blameless party to have to fully internalize the costs of her action, where this unfairness renders a posited theory unacceptable. The papers argue that one cannot resolve this trilemma by rejecting either Proposition 1 or Proposition 3. Thus, one must resolve the trilemma by rejecting the compensation thesis. Finally, the paper has objected to 6 potential arguments in support of the thesis. Given the absence of a successful supporting argument for the compensation thesis and the 2 arguments against it, the compensation thesis should be rejected.